Hello, welcome back to Tales from the Potting Bench. I'm Adam, a gardener, writer, and podcaster with a passion for hearing people's stories and sharing them with you. Before we get into this week's episode, I'd like to ask, if you listen to this podcast and enjoy it, then please consider rating and leaving a review on your podcast platform of choice. It's easy to do, takes just a few minutes of your time, but it helps this podcast get into the ears of more like-minded planty people. I'm thrilled to say that this podcast continues to be sponsored by the wonderful people at PlantGrow, producers of award-winning organic compost, mulch and fertiliser made with zero chemicals. Great for your garden and even greater for the planet. And I know, because it's all I use on my garden. And don't forget, if you use the code POTTINGBENCH on plantgrow.co.uk, you'll get 10% off your order. This is now the sixth season of the podcast, and this time we're doing things slightly differently, as over the course of the coming weeks, we'll be hearing from some of the most inspiring and interesting women across the UK, as I bring them together in what I'm calling a celebration of women in plants. I am constantly inspired by the women around me, and it's high time that we're able to bring them together and share their passion with them. So, let's introduce my next guest. Often, the downfall of many a lost plant is an untoward pest or disease that its custodian is unable to identify or treat accordingly. Thankfully, my guest this week is known to many as one of the foremost authorities on that exact topic, and she's here to discuss it all. Pippa Greenwood is a regular panellist on BBC Radio 4's Gardener's Question Time and is known across the world as an expert on Grow Your Own too. I do hope that you enjoy our conversation with someone I and many other people consider to be a gardening legend. Enjoy. So, for anyone who is not familiar with you right now, who are you and what do you do?
Well, I'm Pippa Greenwood, and I'm really lucky. That's who I am. I've spent all my life working in something which I absolutely love, and that's horticulture, gardening, all aspects of it. I started out training as a botanist and then specialised in crop protection, so the pests and the diseases side of things, which is where I spent a lot of my working life. My first job was working for a biological control person, so somebody who works out what works and also breeds all those wonderful little critters that you can introduce into your garden or your greenhouse to control pests for you without any environmental impact and without any risk to the dog or the cat or the kids. So that was really interesting. I then started working at the RHS Gardens at Wisley, which was a lovely job. I was there for just over 11 years as the plant pathologist. So it sounds very grand, that, doesn't it? But actually what it really is plant diseases. And I absolutely adore plant diseases. So it was a fascinating job. And as I say, I was there for 11 years. But then I got asked to join the presenting team on Gardener's World. And so I was on Gardener's World for, I believe, around about 18 years, which is amazing. And overlapping with that, I got invited on to Radio 4's Gardener's Question Time, and I'm still doing that. And yesterday, somebody told me that I've been on there for over 30 years, which is somewhat terrifying. But it's, having said that, it's 30 years of absolute pure joy and excitement and sometimes hilarity, but it's wonderful. And of course, I do quite a bit of writing and so forth as well, and I've got my own website, so lots of things like that that directly towards the gardening public, if you like. But then also 4 years ago I took up a job, an employed grown-up job, working for the HTA, which is the Horticultural Trades Association. And the main areas that I work on with the HTA are plant health and biosecurity, because that's my background, but also very much the grower members. The grower members, all those people that produce the gorgeous plants in your garden centres and supermarkets and everywhere else. And of course, also the plants for landscapers to put into the landscape, or if you employ someone to come and redo your garden. And our members are the sort of people that grow those plants.
Well, so many things. I think, I mean, you've summarized all the many things that you've done. I think a tremendous amount of people will know you from Gardener's Question Time. And I certainly, that is absolutely the first place that I was aware of you as a baby gardener. Now, you're often lovingly described on GQT as GQT's resident pest and disease expert, which is a wonderful, wonderful moniker, isn't it? What is it about pests and indeed diseases that has fascinated you for so long?
Just about everything. I love a little bit of difficulty. I've never regretted going into horticulture as a career. It's the best. But I've always thought that if I hadn't done that, I would have been interested in, and in some ways I know I would have hated it as well, a career as a lawyer, because I love a really good disagreement and a good verbal wrangle. And so it's, and something wrong that needs sorting. So I, to be honest, I can tell you exactly when it started. Do you want to know when it started?
Yeah, absolutely. It's
an obsession, actually. I was about 4, 5 maybe, and I'd gone shopping with my mother, hanging on to the back of the shopping basket on wheels, as you do when you're little, because otherwise you wander off. And we went past the greengrocer, and there they had these amazing blocks of screaming orange marigolds.
Right.
And can't say they necessarily float my boat particularly now, but at that stage I just looked at them and I just wanted them, and I said I want to buy some. And she said, well, okay, we'll buy them on the way back. And I just had pocket money, so you know, I was feeling flush, and I brought a strip, just one strip, because that's all I could afford, of these marigolds. They're already in flower and everything. And I got home and, you know, wanted to plant them. But by then, you know, supper time, boring things that they do to children. And so I couldn't, and put them in the bay window of the house. And the next morning, I belted down the next morning, being Saturday, and to plant them and take them out, because I had my own little garden. And I wasn't a cryy sort of little girl, but I nearly did cry, because they were about 2/3 of the size they had been the previous evening.
Right.
And they were infested with nasty little green looper caterpillars that were just absolutely eating their way through them. And do you know, I think I looked at them then and thought, I'll get you later, even if I can't get you now. And I'm sure that was some sort of something turned, a switch went in my brain.
Yeah. What did you do with those marigolds then? Did you still plant them out?
Well, I hated caterpillars, because I just think they're quite, again, I'm not a squeamish person. I don't scream about spiders and mice or anything else. I find them rather nice. But I don't like caterpillars, I have to say. And so, do you know, I can't remember now. I just remember that I can still see the plants and the horror and the terrible disappointment. I mean, I don't know how much pocket money I was on, but it was probably the whole week's worth. And I was really disappointed. So I honestly can't tell you exactly what I did. But knowing me, I probably will have planted them out anyway, because I don't like wasting things. But what happened next, I can't tell you, other than this lifelong need to make things even again.
I mean, you said yourself there that it is an obsession. It's not a something that's just a part of your life. It's almost your life, isn't it?
The thing is, obsession's kind of got a negative connotation a bit as well, hasn't it? It is a little bit obsessive, but it's also total fascination. I mean, what say insects get up to in their life cycles, and the way something like an aphid, you know, is almost like a Russian doll with all the generations stacked inside it. You know, humans are so boring compared. So I am fascinated, and I think that's what it is. But also, you can, with a bit of knowledge about something, you can tackle a problem so much better than if you don't know. So I'm keen to know for me, but I'm also keen to help other people to understand a bit, because quite often, say, I'm not saying chemicals are the answer to everything, because they certainly aren't, but quite often, if you know a bit about what a pest does and when it does it, you can avoid it, or you can very easily make your plants less appealing, or you can cover them with something if you understand what's going on. So I like to help people get round problems.
I suppose as well, the thing with pests and diseases is that it's something that will be constantly changing, presumably, given climate, given, I don't know, new pests and diseases emerging from other countries, etc. I suppose that's something that's just constantly changing, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, it is gradually changing, or the emphasis will be different one year to another. And yes, you are right, there are things which are generally speaking much more serious now, or much more prevalent than they were even 10, 15 years ago. So yes, there will be changes. I think that the changes are bigger in commercial horticulture because of, you know, imports and so forth. But obviously, we've got a very good plant health regime, which helps to keep them out rather than in, or if they do get in, to sort them out nice and promptly. But yes, you're all right. It does change a bit. But, you know, even if it didn't, there's plenty there
yeah,
to keep me up till. So,
yeah. What do you think is the biggest kind of plight to the average home gardener at the moment in terms of pests and diseases? What's the thing that people are struggling with the most?
I think that the number one will always be slugs. It almost regardless of weather, they'll still come out and do damage or be underground doing damage. They usually feature quite highly in the RHS lists, but even if they don't feature on the top slot, my view would be that's only because people aren't asking because they know what they are. So why ask the RHS about them or anybody else come to that? They are something which regularly recurs on Gardener's Question Time, which I get questions about sent through my website. Slugs don't go away, and because between them they will attack just about anything. Yeah, slugs, I'd say.
We have a huge problem with slugs in our garden, yet we do tackle them in various different ways. And I think we've almost built up, I'm looking at lovingly at my garden, my bare garden at the moment, knowing that in summer it will be full of dahlias. But 2 years ago, I'd almost given up on dahlias because of the slugs. Mm-hmm. They'd attack them so bad. But then the following year, we pretty much went hell for leather and we'd got nematodes and copper rings and slug defences and, you know, biological. And we persevered. And I think you almost can get through any pest and any disease as long as you're willing to an extent to be able to spend the time getting through them, aren't you?
I think there's often some really good solutions, and certainly the range of, you're saying the range of pests has changed. I'd also say that the range of chemicals is dramatically smaller than it used to be, but the range of biological controls is better and better. You know, there's a huge range now of nematodes for all sorts of different things. And certainly for me, the top selling nematode is the one for controlling slugs. But then, you know, also things like vine weevil, ants, most of the vegetable pests, caterpillars, leather jackets in your lawn, chafer grubs in your lawn, just about anything, not anything, but a wide range can be controlled with the nematodes, and they work well. And as I say, if you know a bit about what time of year or what stage in the plant's growth a pest is going to attack, it might help you to avoid them. Or if you know that rusts love a fairly humid, moist environment, if you just use your head a little bit and you think, okay, I'll plant my leeks a bit further apart. I'll make sure I'm absolutely spot on with my weeding, just so that there's less muggy air around them, then you're going to have a lower level of rust. I'm not saying you won't get any, but you'll get less of a problem.
Yeah, of course. So nematodes, they come up quite a lot as a certainly not a new thing, but it's every year you see a new swathe of people that become aware of them. What exactly are they for people that don't know what they are? Because I think there's this thought, I think it's the toad bit that is strange in people's brains, is that it's almost like a little toad.
Ah, but it's a different spelling, you see. It's not T-O-A-D. Exactly. But no, they do have a tendency to worry some people because, of course, nematodes they're really, really broad range of creatures, and what they do is very, very different one to another. And it's a bit like anything, you get good ones and you get bad ones. And people sometimes have heard of nematodes that can cause horrible infestations in humans or something, but they're totally different. It's like saying, you know, all humans are psychopaths because there are a few out there. Most of us luckily don't seem to be. So with nematodes, they're microscopic worm-like, so worm-shaped creatures, tiny. Only a few can you even see with a hand lens. And the ones that you buy for biological control, they're different sorts depending on what your pest problem is. But mostly they then swim through, say let's deal with the one for slugs or the one for vine weevils. They swim through the soil moisture, which is why you've got to keep the soil moist, and then they latch onto the pest. And in the case of slugs, they give it an infection, which is naturally occurring in slugs in your garden, but this is a sort of bulked up version of it. So they then stop feeding, stop eating, and then die. And the great thing is that if a bird or a hedgehog were to come along and want to eat that dying slug or dead slug, which generally animals are more sensible than humans, they don't eat already dead things. Mm. But if it were to do that, it wouldn't harm them. So that's why they're so useful. But they are tiny. So I always say to people, it's a bit like the Emperor's New Clothes. You can't really see what you're buying. You buy a little flat tray of sticky looking dust. And you divide it up and you mix it with water and put it through a wide holed rose on a watering can. It works incredibly well. And a lot of commercial growers use them for some of the pest problems as well. And when your whole livelihood and that of all your staff depends on a lovely crop of plants to sell, you've got to do something that works. So, incredible.
I remember the first time I ordered some, and I remember the packet coming, and I had no idea about them at all before that first time that I bought them. And in my head, I thought I was going to get a little packet of, in a similar to way that when you've got an aphid problem, you order the ladybird, you expect almost like a packet of little creatures or whatever.
Yes,
it is this kind of weird dust, isn't it? And it feels like you're doing, as a physical action, it feels as though you're not really doing anything, you're just watering the garden,
it works really well. And I found certainly with the slug one, there's a slightly cumulative effect, because obviously if you take a pest out before it breeds, you're also looking, you're inadvertently then controlling or reducing the pest numbers for the following season or later in that season. And I don't do it every year at home in the veg plot. I don't need to.
No, I think that's it, isn't it? It's the preventative measure that has that long-term effect. I can talk about pests and diseases all day, and I absolutely love it when I tune into Gardener's Question Time and you're on, because you're guaranteed to have some weird or wonderful question about some sort of pest and disease that everybody's struggling with. You mentioned about 30 years. That's incredible, isn't it? Does it feel like it's been 30 years?
No, do you know, for ages I used to ring up our now retired chairman Eric Robson and say, oh God, Eric, I've got to do this thing, I've got to fill in a form, or someone's going to interview me. I know they're going to ask me, how long, when did we start? And in fact, now I've worked out the way to work it out is around the age of one of the other panelists' children, because that panelist was pregnant when we first did those stand-in programs for the BBC.
Right.
And all I need to do is ask the name of that offspring, the age of that offspring, and I know how long I've been on GQT.
Yeah, that's incredible. Who else has anyone else been on that long?
Yes, and Swithin Bank was there right at the beginning, and I think did one or two with the old team as well.
Yeah.
And Bob Flowerdew has been on for a very similar length of time as well. So, and then, you know, quite a few of the others came along not long afterwards. So,
it's been nice to see that even over the last few years that the panel has kind of changed slightly, like with Ashley, etc. coming in. I think there's all sorts of different takes on things now, aren't there? Have you found that the questions have, over the years, I mean, obviously you'll get recurring kind of themes and questions. Have you found that the questions have changed substantially, or the things that people are questioning or need help with have changed over the years?
As you say, the vast majority are core questions that come up year in, year out, and probably have been since time immemorial and always will be. But I mean, there are definite changes. There's been a resurgence in the interest in growing veg, a little bit in fruit, but vegetables more than fruit. There's been definitely post-lockdown a greater interest in houseplants. There was years ago, but then it sort of died down a bit. And I would say it's definitely something now we hear about more, whether it's how to grow a particular one, whether it's what would suit such and such a room, or whether it's what are these horrible zigzagging little flies around my compost, i.e. they're fungus gnats. So whatever your interest is, I would say there's more on houseplants a bit too.
You mentioned fungus gnats. We can't ignore fungus gnats. What is the, for anyone that hasn't listened to one of those many questions, what is the solution to fungus gnats, Pippa?
Well, can I just explain? They're little tiny, and they are tiny. We're talking a couple of millimetres max.
Mm.
Black flies, fly-like looking things. They've got a weird zigzaggy flight pattern. There's nothing else quite like them you like to see near your houseplants. They're fairly harmless. It's their young maggot stage, which they will lay their eggs on the compost surface of your houseplants or where you're growing cuttings or making cuttings or something, and those will then eat the roots or the bases of the cuttings. So that's really where the problem is, and the fact that people don't like zigzaggy flies on their house plants because they are in their house. What's the solution? First of all, water less, because they feed on the decaying organic matter that you'll get in compost. And particularly if you overwater, then you're more inclined to get a greater amount of fungus. I also find now you open up a bag of compost and it's got fungus in it, and you usually get some toadstools as well. So there's obviously a greater problem with that. Anyway, there's more food there for them. But as I say, what really matters is if they start attacking the roots. So the best control other than that is, first of all, I always suggest putting a tiny mulch on the surface of something dry.
Sure.
So that the female fly doesn't see that as a good place to lay her eggs. If you put a little top dressing of tiny pebbles or something like that on the surface, you're not going to lay an egg in a...
No, it's less attractive.
Exactly. So that's... And if that doesn't work, there is a brilliant biological control, again, which you can use, which you drench onto the compost and it goes through in there and it will sort out the young, which then obviously don't turn into the adults, which... because they're not there, can't lay their eggs. So the nematode control for that works really well as well.
Brilliant. Gosh, we're getting all the solutions for this. It's like a mini GQT in itself, isn't it? So you've mentioned the interest in veg, particularly post-lockdown. That's something that you're not all pest and disease. You're a big veg fan yourself, aren't you? And you've started your grow your own kind of solution for people. What if, for anyone that hasn't seen that, what is that?
Well, it's only available from my website because I want to sort of keep it really well as I need it to be, which is pippagreenwood.com, or one word. And basically, I did this because I know a lot of people that would like to grow veg, and they go into, say, a garden centre, or they get given some plants by a friend and it just says plant 45 centimetres apart, and then kind of abandons you. And if you've not grown veg before, that's not going to get you anywhere because it doesn't tell you what to do next. And veg do need some input. And so I have a lovely grower in Lincolnshire who raises a lovely range of veg plants for me, all peat free, all sent out in cardboard boxes with paper wraps. So it's very good on the environment front as well. And you go and you choose what you'd like to grow. Because again, I don't like veg packs, predetermined veg packs, because say I don't like sweet corn or I don't like butternut squash. What on earth do I want to grow them for? I want to grow things I want to eat, or my family wants to eat, or I know my friends would love as a present. So you choose what you want to grow. And then starting just before the plants arrive, and we send them out in mid-May so that you can safely plant them outside. There are some you can grow in a greenhouse as well. Obviously, we've got melons and cucumbers and things. But most of them are outdoor crops because that's what most people have got. And you get approximately weekly emails from me from just before they arrive, telling you everything you need to know. So unpacking them, planting distances, what to do to them when it's time to prick them out, when it's time to thin them, general sort of cultivation advice as well. So when weeds are particularly bad one year, you'll get an extra thing on that. If there's an outbreak of flea beetles or something, I'll tell you, oh, it's coming, this is what you need to do, or now you've got them, this is the way around it, right the way through to harvesting. So it's at your elbow advice. As one of my customers wrote in a lovely review, she said, it's like having you in my garden, to which my family put their collective heads in their hands and said, oh no. But yes, so because I want to encourage people who've maybe never grown veg before to do it and succeed enough to know that they can do it again. I mean, a lot of my customers have been coming back for years since I started this, but it is something that means you could do it when you've never done it before.
Yeah.
Because we go right back to basics. And I'm very honest with what's going on as well, because I think if it's a very bad year for a certain crop, if say you were a novice gardener and you'd never grown, what should we pick on this time? You'd never grown beetroot before. I want you to know that my beetroot crop is disastrous if it's something down to the weather or whatever it might be. And so I'll say, oh, you know, the beetroot aren't growing as they should do this year, or everything's a bit slow. Or I'll say the butternut squash are dollhouse sized this year, because I need you to know that it's not you can't do it. It's that the weather's against you. And next year, hopefully the weather will be with you.
Yeah, definitely. I love this resurgence in growing your own veg, because I know it is a cliche, and you can't say it without it sounding like a cliche, but you cannot beat the taste of grow your own. And I think that's the thing that you want to encourage people to have. I've had this conversation with someone about tomatoes the other day, and I know we've struggled kind of seemingly endlessly with blight and stuff, but I think that picking a warm tomato off a plant and eating it when it's just warmed by the sun, and you might have a basil plant, and you wrap that tomato in a basil leaf, and you cannot, and I guarantee you can taste that as I'm describing it. You can't beat that.
Yeah, you can't beat it. And in so many other ways, it's really good as well. The taste, the flavour, the freshness. Also, if something's fresh, it tends to have a better nutrient content. Mm. But I also think it's incredibly rewarding. So it's therefore also really good for your head. I love boring people and sitting them around the table and saying, oh, do you like those beans? That's the first time I've grown this type of bean. Or, oh, how do you rate those lettuces? Aren't they really lovely and tender? And you know, you've got three different types of lettuce, all different colours and levels of frilliness. And I actually think it makes you feel good when you produce something from scratch. It's far too easy to get everything done for you now. And I'm not saying I'm certainly not a hair shirt wearer, but I do think it's good sometimes to go back to basics, because you get one huge thrill from it. And producing a lovely meal, which at least in part, if not in whole, is from your garden, phenomenal.
Can't be beaten.
And also, you can have it when you need it more. So say with our lettuces, I suggest ways of harvesting them to the people that are growing them, so that the lettuce plants last as long as possible. Mm. And if you go to the supermarket and you buy a bag of salad leaves, it's all there and it's all the same age. And if you're eating lots of salad, that's great. If you're not eating quite so much, you end up with a bag of slippery slime and you've wasted it. And that seems like a real shame. So when you've got it growing in the garden, you just walk out there, or if it's on your allotment, you go and get what you need. You don't have to get everything all at once.
Yeah, love it. We could talk about veg all day long, couldn't we? I can feel a second episode coming at some point. But it's reached that part of the podcast where I've got three questions for you. Three questions that you don't know, three questions that you purposely don't know.
Okay.
And they're kind
it's like
of
being in God's question time.
Pre-preparation with this. So I've got one question for you from me, one from Jekka McVicar, and then I'd like you to leave a question for the next guest and answer it yourself.
Oh,
are you ready?
Yes.
Okay. Let's go in easy, and I'll ask you my question first. So we've gone through all of the different pests and diseases, and we know there are solutions for a tremendous amount of things. But even as the pest and disease expert that you are, what is one plant that you always struggle to grow and just cannot get to grips with?
Cauliflowers. Luckily, I only like eating them about twice a year, because I'm not sure whether I like them or not, but I can't grow them.
Okay.
I can grow the other brassicas just fine. I cannot get a decent head on a cauliflower.
Do you know why?
Oh, I've had all sorts of excuses made for me by all sorts of people. It could be so many things, but I really can't do it.
Okay.
The plants look fine. Decent head, no. It's the sort of situation where it's too small, it's too open, it goes from definitely not ready to blown look. So I'm sure it's largely to do with the soil, not to do with the operator. But I really don't know. I'm absolutely useless at it, but I have pursued it just as a matter of principle, but I've not pursued it like I might do with something I really wanted lots of and
really enjoyed. Yeah.
If you told me sweet corn, nothing is better than homegrown sweet corn, I would carry on and on and on until I'd grown every variety that's out there in every position in my garden, starting in every day of the possible week, you know. So, but no, okay. Cauliflowers,
fine. All right, let's go with that. The second question then is from the absolute champion of the herb world, Jekka McVicar. What is the most important thing in your garden?
That's some question, Jekka.
Isn't it? Isn't
Thank
it?
You.
I know. Cruel, I think.
You wait. The most important thing is, without any doubt, the soil, the garden itself, if that's an answer to the question. Because without the soil being as it needs to be. Now, I garden on really heavy clay that's also strongly alkaline. So it's got its personal issues, shall we say. That's a modern way of putting it. But it also is actually fundamentally pretty fertile. But without the organic matter, large trailer full of manure turning up on Friday. Guess what? No, actually, it's Saturday. Guess what I'm going to spend doing at the weekend is, you know, that is really, really important to everything, because the microorganisms in there, the critter life, the everything life that goes on there is just it.
It's
that's a very
it.
Deep question, Becca.
No, I know, it's really cruel. I think we'll get some people, you know, there might, you could take it two ways, can't you? And you can go with an actual physical, this particular thing, or what is the most important thing to a garden. So I think it's quite a good open question, that one. But now you've got to now you're going to be leaving a question for my next guest. No, but because of the way that these work, I might not necessarily be recording them in the order that they go out in, so I'm not going to say who that's for. But what is your question, bearing in mind that you've got to answer it to me as well?
Oh, I think this is much worse than the rest of everything, just to let you know. I don't like it one little bit. Okay, what would I say? I'm going to go for a bit of a cop-out here, because it's a question that I've been asked on more than one occasion myself, but I think is a good question to someone like myself, who I'm assuming your next guest may not be totally different, who deals with the great British public and their gardens and their gardening problems and positives and everything. And that is, what's the best bit of advice you would give to a gardener who was new, but who you didn't really know anything much about? So if you had to give a bit of sort of generic advice, what would that be?
And if I were to ask you that, what would your answer be?
I would say, without a doubt, never give up. And I would say, just take any disappointment as being something that you can learn from, because that's so true in gardening. And I think, you know, with some things, if you take a car out and you crash it, that really is pretty disastrous. If you are in your garden and you grow a plant for the first time and it doesn't do what you'd hoped, and you know that maybe you could have done something differently, then obviously if it's an annual, you start again the next year. If it's a perennial, you do what you did slightly differently. And it really doesn't matter. Plants are a lot more resilient than people will sometimes have you believe. So often you can get away with things you shouldn't have done. But just have another go and keep on smiling, because nothing always works first time, including gardening.
You can find out more from Pippa by following her on Instagram at Pippa_Greenwood, and also through her website, pippagreenwood.com. Join me again next week, where I'll be in conversation with someone else from the world of plants. But until then, do make sure to rate and review on your podcast platform of choice. You can also see what I'm up to in my garden by following me on Instagram at View From The Potting Bench. See you again next week.